I'm going to begin reading again on page 105. We went into the gym along a marble hallway, and to my surprise we went on past the trophy room, where Finney's name was already inscribed on one cup, one banner, and one embalmed football. I was sure that this was his goal, to mull over these lost glories. I had prepared myself for that, and even thought of several positive, uplifting aphorisms to cheer him up. But he went by it without a thought, down a stairway, steep in marble, and into the locker room. I went along, mystified, beside him. There was a pile of dirty towels in a corner. Finney shoved them with a crutch. "What is all this crap?" he muttered with a little smile, "about no maids." The locker room was empty at this hour, row after row of dull green lockers separated by wide wooden benches. The ceiling was hung with pipes. It was a drab room for Devon, dull green and brown and gray. But at the far end there was a big marble archway, glisteningly white, which led to the pool. Finney sat down on a bench, struggled out of his sheep-lined winter coat, and took a deep breath of gymnasium air. No locker room could have more pungent air than Devon's. Sweat predominated, but it was richly mingled with smells of paraffin and singed rubber, of soaked wool and liniment, and for those who could interpret it, of exhaustion, lost hope, and triumph, and bodies battling against each other. I thought it anything but a bad smell. It was preeminently the smell of the human body after it had been used to the limit, such a smell as has meaning and poignance for any athlete, just as it has for any lover. Phineas looked down here and there, at the exercise bar over a sandpit next to the wall, at a set of weights on the floor, at the rolled-up wrestling mat, at a pair of spiked shoes kicked under a locker. "Same old place, isn't it?" he said, turning to me and nodding slightly. After a moment I answered in a quiet voice, "Not exactly." He made no pretense of not understanding me. After a pause he said, "You're going to be the big star now," in an optimistic tone, and then added with some embarrassment, "You can fill any gaps or anything." He slapped me on the back. "Get over there and chin yourself a few dozen times. What did you finally go out for?" "I finally didn't go out." "You aren't," his eyes burned at me from his grimacing face, "still the assistant senior crew manager." "No, I quit that. I've just been going to gym classes, the ones they have for guys who aren't going out for anything." He wrenched himself around on the bench. Joking was past, his mouth widened irritably. "What the hell," his voice bounded on the word in a sudden rich descent, "did you do that for?" It was too late to sign up for anything else. And seeing the energy to blast this excuse rushing to his face and neck, I stumbled on, "And anyway, with the war on, there won't be many trips for the teams. I don't know. Sports don't seem so important with the war on." "Have you swallowed all that war stuff?" "No, of course I was so committed to refuting him that I had half denied the charge before I understood it. Now my eyes swung back to his face. "All what war stuff?" "All that stuff about there being a war on." "I don't think I get what you mean. Do you really think the United States of America is in a state of war with Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan?" "Do I really think?" My voice trailed off. He stood up, his weight on the good leg, the other resting lightly on the floor in front of him. "Don't be a sap." He gazed with cool self-possession at me. "There isn't any war." "I know why you're talking like this," I said, struggling to keep up with him. "Now I understand. You're still under the influence of some medicinal drug." "No, you are. Everybody is." He pivoted so that he was facing directly at me. "That's what this whole war story is, a medicinal drug. Listen, did you ever hear of the Roaring Twenties?" I nodded very slowly and cautiously. "When they all drank bathtub gin, and everybody who was young did just what they wanted?"
"Yes."
"Well, what happened was that they didn't like that, the preachers and the old ladies and all the stuffed shirts. So then they tried prohibition, and everybody just got drunker. So then they really got desperate and arranged the Depression. That kept the people who were young in the 30s in their places. But they couldn't use that trick forever, so for us in the 40s they've cooked up this war fake." "Who are they, anyway?" "Fat old men who don't want us crowding them out of their jobs. They've made it all up. There isn't any real food shortage, for instance. The men have all the best steaks delivered to their clubs now. You've noticed how they've been getting fatter lately, haven't you?" His tone took it thoroughly for granted that I had. For a moment I was almost taken in by it. Then my eyes fell on the bound and cast white mass, pointing at me, and as it was always to do, brought me down out of Finney's world of invention, down again as I had fallen after awakening that morning, down to reality, to the facts. Phineas, this is all pretty amusing and everything, but I hope you don't play this game too much with yourself. You might start to believe it, and then I'd have to make a reservation for you at the funny farm. In a way, deep in argument, his eyes never wavered from mine. The whole world is on a funny farm now, but it's only the fat old men who get the joke. And you. Yes, and me. What makes you so special? Why should you get it, and all the rest of us be in the dark? The momentum of the argument abruptly broke from his control. His face froze. Because I've suffered, he burst out. We drew back in amazement from this. In the silence, all the flighty spirits of the morning ended between us. He sat down and turned his flushed face away from me. I sat next to him without moving, for as long as my beating nerves would permit, and then I stood up and walked slowly toward anything which presented itself. It turned out to be the exercise bar. I sprang up, grabbed it, and then, in a fumbling and perhaps grotesque offering to Phineas, I chinned myself. I couldn't think of anything else, not the right words, not the right gesture. I did what I could think of. Do 30 of them, he mumbled in a bored voice. I had never done 10 of them. At the 12th, I discovered that he had been counting to himself because he began to count aloud in a noncommittal, half-heard voice. At 18, there was a certain enlargement in his tone, and at 23, the last edges of boredom left it. He stood up, and the urgency with which he brought out the next numbers was like an invisible boost, lifting me the distance of my arms until he sang out 30 with a flare of pleasure. The moment was past. Phineas, I know, had been even more startled than I to discover this bitterness in himself. Neither of us ever mentioned it again, and neither of us ever forgot that it was there. He sat down and studied his clenched hands. Did I ever tell you, he began in a husky tone, that I used to be aiming at the Olympics? He wouldn't have mentioned it except that after what he had said, he had to say something very personal, something deeply held. To do otherwise, to begin joking, would have been a hypocritical denial of what had happened, and Phineas was not capable of that. I was still hanging from the bar. My hands felt as though they had sunk into it. No, you never told me that, I mumbled into my arm. Well, I was. And now I'm not completely sure, not 100% sure I'll be completely, you know, in shape by 1944, so I'm going to coach you for them instead. But there isn't going to be any Olympics in 44. That's only a year away. The war... Leave your fantasy life out of this. We're grooming you for the Olympics, pal, in 1944. And not believing him, not forgetting the troops were being shuttled toward battlefields all over the world, I went along, as I always did, with any new invention of Finney's. There was no harm in taking aim, even if the target was a dream. I'd like to move ahead now to page 117. Leper has just departed for the war. A week later, he was gone. He had been within a few weeks of his 18th birthday, and with it all chance of enlistment, of choosing a service rather than being drafted into one, would have disappeared. The ski movie had decided him. I always thought the war would come to me when it wanted me, he said, when he came to say goodbye the last day. I never thought I'd be going to it. I'm really glad I saw that movie in time. You bet I am. Then, as the Devon School's first recruit to World War II, he went out of my doorway with his white stocking cap bobbing behind. It probably would have been better for all of us if someone like Brinker had been the first to go. He could have been depended upon to take a loud, dramatic departure, so that the school would have reverberated for weeks afterward with Brinker's last words, Brinker's military bearing, Brinker's sense of duty. And all of us, influenced by the vacuum of his absence, would have felt the touch of war as a daily fact. But the disappearing tale of Leper's cap inspired none of this. For a few days, the war was more unimaginable than ever. We didn't mention it, and we didn't mention Leper, until at last Brinker found a workable point of view. One day, in the butt room, he read aloud a rumor in a newspaper about an attempt on Hitler's life. He lowered the paper, gazed in a visionary way in front of him, and then remarked, "That was Leper, of course." This established our liaison with World War II. The Tunisian campaign became Leper's Liberation, the bombing of the Ruhr, was greeted by Brinker with hurt surprise. He didn't tell us he'd left the ski troops. The torpedoing of the Scharnhorst. At it again. Lepers sprang up all over the world at the core of every Allied success. We talked about Leper's stand at Stalingrad, Leper on the Burma Road, Leper's convoy to Archangel. We surmised that the crisis over the leadership of the Free French would be resolved by the appointment neither of de Gaulle nor Giraud, but Lepelier. We knew, better than the newspapers, that it was not the Big Three, but the Big Four who were running the war. In the silences between jokes about Leper's glories, we wondered whether we ourselves would measure up to the humblest minimum standard of the army. I did not know everything there was to know about myself, and knew that I did not know it. I wondered in the silences between jokes about Leper whether the still hidden parts of myself might contain the sad sack, the outcast, or the coward. We were all at our funniest about Leper, and we all secretly hoped that Leper, that incompetent, was as heroic as we said. Everyone contributed to this legend except Phineas. At the outset, with the attempt on Hitler's life, Finney had said, "If someone gave Leper a loaded gun and put it at Hitler's temple, he'd miss." There was a general shout of outrage, and then we recommenced the building of Leper's triumphal arch around Brinker's keystone. Phineas took no part in it, and since little else was talked about in the butt room, he soon stopped going there and stopped me from going there as well. How do you expect to be an athlete if you smoke like a forest fire? He drew me increasingly away from the butt room crowd, away from Brinker and Chet and all other friends, into a world inhabited by just himself and me, where there was no war at all, just Phineas and me alone, among all the people of the world, training for the Olympics of 1944. I might just explain, I forgot to mention the butt room, B-U-T-T, refers to the rooms in the basement of the dormitories at the Devon School, where the students are very grudgingly permitted to smoke cigarettes. Soon after Leper's departure, the real melancholia of a New England winter sets in. Winters in New England, for those of you lucky enough not to live there, last interminably, and for an adolescent boys cooped up in a school, by late February, they begin to go a little crazy. Or they used to, at least. So, as usual, Phineas rescues them. He organizes a winter carnival, and they build all kinds of snow figures and have all kinds of games, and they daringly drink hard cider and do all kinds of things like that. And at the end of the carnival, a student arrives with a telegram for Jean Forrester. The telegram is from Leper, and summoning Jean to visit him, Leper, at his home in Vermont. Jean is completely amazed. He can't imagine. Well, he decides finally that Leper must be on leave, and the telegram is very urgent that Jean comes, so he does. It very soon becomes clear that Leper has had a severe nervous breakdown. Instead of being the dreamy, pleasant, abstract scientist-to-be that he had been at Devon, he is violent, emotionally resentful, and in general, he is in a very bad state mentally. This was by no means unknown in World War II, and I'm sure in any war, many young men going into the service simply can't stand it mentally, and they just wake up one morning and can't get out of bed, literally, or something, and they are taken to the hospital and often discharged from the service. They simply can't adjust, and this has happened to Leper. This very much terrifies Jean Forrester. Here's the first person he ever knew to go into the military service, and this person returns mentally broken down and emotionally broken down. So Jean returns to Devon and becomes, if anything, even closer to Phineas. The term is approaching its close. We're now in the month of May, a few weeks to go before the year ends, and these boys, those of them who are physically able, that excludes Phineas, will be going into the military service. One day, Phineas sees Leper creeping, hiding around the campus and going into the office of one of the teachers, Mr. Carhart. Phineas returns to their room and tells Jean that leper is creeping around the campus. Jean and Phineas are the only two people who know that leper has returned. I'll resume reading on page 156. Brinker and three cohorts came with much commotion into our room at 10.05 p.m. that night. "We're taking you out," he said flatly. "It's after hours," I said. "Where?" said Finney with interest at the same time. "You'll see. Get them." His friends half lifted us, half roughly, and we were hustled down the stairs. I thought it must be some kind of culminating prank, the senior class leaving Devon with a flourish. Were we going to steal the clapper out of the school bell, or would we tether a cow in chapel? They steered us toward the first building, burned down and rebuilt several times, but still called the first building of the Devon School. It contained only classrooms, and so at this hour was perfectly empty, which made us stealthier than ever. Brinker's many keys, surviving from his class officer period, jingled softly as we reached the main door. Above us in Latin flowed the inscription, "Here boys come to become men." The lock turned. We went in, entering the doubtful reality of a hallway familiar only in daylight and bustle. Our footsteps fell guiltily on the marble floor. We continued across the foyer to a dreamlike bank of windows, turned left up a pale flight of marble steps, left again, through two doorways, and into the assembly room. From the high ceiling, one of the celebrated Devon chandeliers, all glittering tiers, scattered thin illumination. Row after row of black, early American benches spread emptily back through the shadows to long, vague windows. At the front of the room, there was a raised platform with a balustrade in front of it. About 10 members of the senior class sat on the platform. All of them were wearing their black graduation robes. This is going to be some kind of schoolboy masquerade, I thought. Some masquerade with masks and candles. "You see how Finney limps," said Brinker loudly as we walked in. It was too coarse and too loud. I wanted to hit him for shocking me like that. Phineas looked perplexed. "Sit down," he went on. "Take a load off your feet." We sat in the front row of the benches, where 8 or 10 others were sitting, smirking uneasily at the students on the platform. Whatever Brinker had in his mind to do, I thought he had chosen a terrible place for it. There was nothing funny about the assembly room. I could remember staring torpidly through these windows 100 times out at the elms of the center common. The windows now had the closed blankness of night, a deadened look about them, a look of being blind or deaf. The great expanses of wall space were opaque with canvas, portraits in oil of deceased headmasters, a founder or two, forgotten leaders of the faculty, a beloved athletic coach none of us had ever heard of, a lady we could not identify. Her fortune had largely rebuilt the school. A nameless poet who was thought, when under the school's protection, to be destined primarily for future generations. Young hero, now anonymous, who looked theatrical in the First World War uniform in which he had died. I thought any prank was bound to fall flat here. The assembly hall was used for large lectures, debates, plays, and concerts. It had the worst acoustics in the school. I couldn't make out what Brinker was saying. He stood on the polished marble floor in front of us, but facing the platform, talking to the boys behind the balustrade. I heard him say the word inquiry to them, and something about the country demands. "What is all this hot air?" I said into the blur. "I don't know," Finney answered shortly. As he turned toward us, Brinker was saying, "Blame on the responsible party. We will begin with a brief prayer." He paused, surveying us with the kind of wild-eyed surmise Mr. Carhart always used at this point, and then added in Mr. Carhart's urbane murmur, "Let us pray." We all slumped immediately and unthinkingly into the awkward crouch in which God was addressed to Devon, leaning forward with elbows on knees. Brinker had caught us, and in a moment it was too late to escape, for he had moved swiftly into the Lord's Prayer. If, when Brinker had said, "Let us pray," I had said, "Go to hell," everything might have been saved. At the end, there was an indecisive, semi-serious silence, and then Brinker said, "Phineas, if you please." Finney got up with a shrug and walked to the center of the floor, between us and the platform. Brinker got an armchair from behind the balustrade and seated Finney on it with courtly politeness. "Now, just in your own words," he said. "What own words?" said Phineas, grimacing up at him with his best you-are-an-idiot expression. "I know you haven't got many of your own," said Brinker with a charitable smile. "Use some of Jean's, then. What shall I talk about? You? I've got plenty of words of my own for that." "I'm all right." Brinker glanced gravely around the room for confirmation. "You're the casualty." "Brinker," began Finney in a constricted voice I did not recognize, "are you off your head or what?" "No," said Brinker evenly. "That's Leper, our other casualty. Tonight we're investigating you." "What the hell are you talking about?" I cut in suddenly. "Investigating Finney's accident." He spoke as though this was the most natural and self-evident and inevitable thing we could be doing. I felt the blood flooding into my head. "After all," Brinker continued, "there is a war on. Here's one soldier our side has already lost. We've got to find out what happened." "Just for the record," said someone from the platform, "you agree, don't you, Jean?" "I told Brinker this morning," I began in a voice treacherously shaking, "that I thought this was the worst." "And I said," Brinker's voice was full of authority and perfectly under control, "that for Finney's good, and with an additional timber of sincerity, and for your own good, too, by the way, Jean, that we should get all this out into the open. We don't want any mysteries or any stray rumors and suspicions left in the air at the end of the year, do we?" A collective assent to this rumbled through the blurring atmosphere of the assembly room. "What are you talking about?" Finney's voice was full of contemptuous music. "What rumors and suspicions?" "Never mind about that," said Brinker, with his face responsibly grave. "He's enjoying this," I thought bitterly. "He's imagining himself justice incarnate, balancing the scales. He's forgotten that justice incarnate is not only balancing the scales, but also blindfolded." "Why don't you just tell us in your own words what happened?" Brinker continued. "Just humor us, if you want to think of it that way. We aren't trying to make you feel bad. Just tell us. You know we wouldn't ask you if we didn't have a good reason. Good reasons. There's nothing to tell." "Nothing to tell?" Brinker looked pointedly at the small cast around Finney's lower leg and the cane he held between his knees. "Well, then, I fell out of a tree." "Why?" said someone on the platform. "The acoustics were so bad and the lights so dim that I could rarely tell who was speaking, except for Finney and Brinker, who were isolated on the wide strip of marble floor between us in the seats and the others on the platform." "Why?" repeated Finney. "Because I took a wrong step." "Did you lose your balance?" continued the voice. "Yes," echoed Finney grimly. "I lost my balance." "You had better balance than anyone in the school." "Thanks a lot." "I didn't say it for a compliment." "Well, then, no thanks." "Have you ever thought that you didn't just fall out of that tree?" This touched an interesting point Phineas had been turning over in his mind for a long time. I could tell that because the obstinate, competitive look left his face as his mind became engaged for the first time. "It's very funny," he said, "but ever since then I've had a feeling that the tree did it by itself. It's an impression I've had, almost as though the tree shook me out by itself." The acoustics in the assembly room were so poor that silences there had a heavy hum of their own. "Someone else was in the tree, isn't that so?" "No," said Finney spontaneously. "I don't think so." He looked at the ceiling. "Or was there? Maybe there was somebody climbing up the rungs of the trunk. I kind of forget." This time the hum of silence was prolonged to a point where I would be forced to fill it with some kind of sound if it didn't end. Then someone else in the platform spoke up. "I thought somebody told me that Jean Forrester was..." "Finney was there," Brinker interrupted commandingly. "He knows better than anyone." "You were there too, weren't you, Jean?" this new voice from the platform continued. "Yes," I said with interest. "Yes, I was there too." "Were you near the tree?" Finney turned toward me. "You were down at the bottom, weren't you?" he asked, not in the official courtroom tone he'd used before, but in a friend's voice. I had been studying very carefully the way my hands wrinkled when tightly clenched, but I was able to bring my head up and return his inquiring look. "Down at the bottom, yes." Finney went on. "Did you see the tree shake or anything?" He flushed faintly at what seemed to him the absurdity of his own question. "I've always meant to ask you, just for the hell of it. I took this under consideration. I don't recall anything like that." "Nutty question," he muttered. "I thought you were in the tree," the platform voice cut in. Well, of course, Finney said in an exasperated chuckle. Of course I was in the tree. Oh, you mean Jean. He wasn't in it. Is that what you mean, or... Finney floundered with muddled honesty between me and my questioner. I meant Jean, the voice said. Of course Finney was in the tree, I said. But I couldn't make the confusion last. And I was at the bottom, or climbing the rungs, I think. How do you expect him to remember, said Finney sharply. There was a hell of a lot of confusion right then. A kid I used to play with was hit by a car once when I was about 11 years old, said Brinker seriously. And I remember every single thing about it, exactly where I was standing, the color of the sky, the noise the brakes of the car made. I never will forget anything about it. You and I are two different people, I said. No one's accusing you of anything, Brinker responded in an odd tone. Well, of course no one's accusing me. Don't argue so much. His voice tried for a hard compromise, full of warning and yet striving to pass unnoticed by the others. No, we're not accusing you, a boy on the platform said evenly. And then I stood accused. I think I remember now, Finney broke in, his eyes bright and relieved. Yes, I remember seeing you standing on the bank. You were looking up and your hair was plastered down over your forehead, so that you had that dumb look you always have when you've been in the water. What was it you said? Stop posing up there, or one of those best pal cracks you're always making. Finney was very happy. And I think I did start to pose just to make you madder. And I said, what did I say? Something about the two of us, yes. I said, let's make a double jump, because I thought if we went together, it would be something that had never been done before, holding hands in a jump. Then it was as though someone had suddenly slapped him. No, that was on the ground when I said that to you. I said that to you on the ground, and then the two of us started to climb. He broke off. The two of you, the boy on the platform went on harshly for him, started to climb up the tree together. Was that it? And he just said he was on the ground. Or on the rungs, I burst out. I said I might have been on the rungs. Who else was there? Said Brinker quietly. Leper Lepelier was there, wasn't he? Yes, someone said. Leper was there. Leper always was the exact type when it came to details, continued Brinker. He could have told us where everybody was standing, what everybody was wearing, the whole conversation that day, what the temperature was. He could have cleared the whole thing up. Too bad.